Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.
Welcome to Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and every weekend at this time, we get to talk sports with some really, really interesting people right here on AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Jeffrey Sennis is doing our engineering today. Andrew Hurd Liska, the producing, and Jack McCallum, former senior writer at Sports Illustrated for 30 years. And he's still on the masthead as a special contributor, but his new book is out, The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson and the Hidden History of Hoops. Jack, it's so nice to catch up with you, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you, Pat. Great talking to you. We go way back, but then again, we go way back with a lot of people.
Jack, how did this book come about? Why did you want to dive into this?
Well, it was during the pandemic that not only was I locked inside like everybody else, but I had a knee replacement, and so I was pretty immobile and miserable, and I just started researching. I wanted to write another book, and I didn't want to do, I wrote The Dream. I'm pretty much associated with Jordan and Magic and Bird, and I was fortunate enough to cover those guys and fortunate enough to have written a book about the Dream Team, but I just wanted to do something different. I started looking at kind of the history of hoops and came upon this story and, knew that the movie Hoosiers is, so popular and so big, and it sort of took over the narrative of what happened. And then when I found out that Oscar Robertson's team, the real one, actually had played the team that Hoosiers is modeled on, that I said, wow, this sounds like a really fascinating subject. So that's what started me.
Tell me about Crispus Attucks High School and why it has such a legend.
Well, back in the 1920s in Indianapolis, it was like a lot of American cities. It was really gone under a lot of transformation, that a lot of African-Americans, a lot of white people too, but a lot of African-Americans were coming north in the Great Migration. They were getting away from Jim Crow laws, and they were trying to find more economic and educational opportunities. So as with a lot of places, African-Americans started to pour into the Indianapolis school system. And a lot of people became worried. Now, it's sort of echoed today. I mean, if you substituted the word African-Americans for migrants, you would get a pretty close approximation of what was going on. So they created a high school, pretty much against federal law, but they created a high school on the west side of Indianapolis, where it was mandated by the school board that all black kids had to go to that high school. Before that, they went to high school like Broad Ripple, and there was Emmanuel Tech. There were a lot of good high schools in Indianapolis, but they created this one in 1922 just for the black kids. It took 4 years to build. And it opened in 1927 with an all-African-American student body, an all-African-American administration, an all-African-American faculty. And they started to create, kind of against what a lot of people thought, they started to create good things in education in Indianapolis.
Where does Oscar Robertson fit into this story?
Well, a lot of the book is the first part of it is kind of a history of, it's kind of more a biography of the high school than it is a biography of Oscar. In the early years of the school, because as I mentioned, they got this great faculty because the educated African-Americans that were coming out of college with master's degrees, sometimes PhDs, the best place for them to teach, they couldn't get jobs at white universities. The historically black colleges in the South didn't pay very much, so they became teachers at Attucks, and they had this unbelievable faculty that produced a Tuskegee Airman came out of there. a couple generals came out of there. All these music people that fed into the music scene that was going on in Indianapolis. The first black police chief, the first black fire chief, the first state representative. So it was sort of a education story for the first few decades. And then in the 1950s, they got this great coach named Ray Crow, who came in, and Oscar's brother, whose nickname was Flap, because of the way he flapped his wrist after hitting a jump shot, in 1951, all of a sudden lifted Crispus Attucks' basketball team, which had not really been very good. They had, and they started winning. And then Oscar comes along. His sophomore year was 53-54. And then it became kind of a basketball story because Oscar's teams were so great. The last 2 years of his high school career, they went, you'd think I remember since I wrote it in the book, but I think they were 60-1. They lost one game, and it just changed the way basketball was played in the state of Indiana, which, as you know, is seminally important to the development of basketball.
What was the Dust Bowl all about?
Well, there was this area in the 1940s. Most of the black families that moved to Indianapolis, typical story, you know, economically deprived, some subtle racism in the real estate market. They ended up on the west side of Indianapolis. And in the 1940s, the Police Athletic League, which, as you know, through the years has done 1,000 great things all over the country, built this playground. And in the beginning, it had a dirt, you know, it wasn't paved. And all the kids on the west side of Indianapolis, pretty much all black, congregated at this playground. It continued, so they called it the Dust Bowl. They continued to call it the Dust Bowl, even though they actually built a pretty good facility. It was paved. So by the time Oscar started playing there, Oscar was born in 38, I believe.
That's right.
So he starts coming over there 1949, 1950. And, you know, I wasn't there, so obviously. So most of this is secondhand. But it was like a serious place, Pat. It was sort of like, yeah, it was playground ball. But you laced your sneakers up, man. And like all playgrounds, you had to play. You had to win to stay on the court. And they had really good coaches. There was a lot of, you know, not fooling around. This was the era of not trash talking. So you learned to play basketball at the Dust Bowl. You learned to compete. You learned to fight for yourself. But you also learned pretty good fundamental basketball. And it is of seminal importance to the development of basketball in Indianapolis, particularly the kids that went to Crispus Attucks played at the Dust Bowl.
Jack McCallum is our guest, a former longtime writer at Sports Illustrated. The book, The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson and the Hidden History of Hoops. My favorite chapter in the book, Chapter 5, Hoops, the Hoosier State's Most Glorious Input. Hoosier Hysteria. What's the deal with basketball in the state of Indiana? What's your take, Jack?
Well, the basketball, as you know, not that you were around, Pat, but me and you know that basketball is that rare sport that we know where it was invented. Everything else we're still arguing about, right? I mean, we still argue about, I mean, baseball has this nice story of, and I'm glad Cooperstown exists, but you know, the origin story of baseball, lacrosse, football, most sports is pretty vague. It's ambivalent. We know that in December of 1891, that a guy named Dr. James Naismith nailed up his peach baskets in the Springfield. It was a Springfield College instructor. And he nailed up the peach baskets to get his unruly gym class in order. And they started playing basketball, which I always love that. It was the first way it was spelled was two words. It was basket, space, ball. That sticks in my head for some reason. the rules of basketball have, that's the first one that comes up, baskets, baseball. Anyway, so he invents it in 1891. And the way that game, how fast that game spread is one of the true miracle stories of sports. By apparently what happened was through the YMCA, Naismith, you know, sort of that muscular Christianity philosophy, you know, that you took care of the mind, the spirit, and the body, that one of Naismith's most enthusiastic disciples took the game to Indiana. And for whatever variety of reasons the state took to it, it was a sport that could be played cheaply. It was a sport that seemed to fit the ethos of small towns. You attacked the boar and farms. You know, it was both rural, and now it's an urban sport. It started out in Indiana as a rural sport. You know, you tacked the basket to your farm, and you invented some kind of ball out of a, you know, a hay ball or something, and you threw it through the ring. And so by 1911, which is 20 years after Naismith invented the game, the Indiana high school tournament begins.
Mm.
And the Indiana high school tournament was really the engine that drove the development of basketball in Indiana and a lot of other places. It was and has long been the model for scholastic sports. I mean, it was a huge tournament. By now, the first year, it wasn't. But it grew and grew and grew and grew, and it was fed by all these small towns. You know, you could be a small place and win the Indiana high school tournament. And I really think the ethos of Indiana basketball came out of that small town fervor that was fueled by the state tournament. That was really the ingredient that put it together.
Jack McCallum is our guest. His book, The Real Hoosiers. We have another segment with Jack. The show, Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. And this is AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Jack McCallum wrote for Sports Illustrated for many, many years, and what a writer he was and is. The new book is out, The Real Hoosiers. There's another fascinating chapter, Jack, called The Secret Spread of Black Basketball. Explain that to us.
Well, I think when I was growing up, Pat, in the 1950s, it is impossible to tell today's audience how important the Harlem Globetrotters were. I mean, my father, I was born in South Jersey. My father took me down to see the Globetrotters in 7 years old, the mid-50s. And to a lot of America, this was, you know, it was still pretty segregated. There weren't that many black players in the NBA, as you know better than I do. You know, they came in slowly and probably did not begin the dominance until, you know, Bill Russell, Elgin Baylor, Wilt, late 50s, right?
Yeah.
I'd say that's probably when it started to turn into a little bit of an African-American game. But anyway, for most of America, the Harlem Globetrotters, which were a brilliant band of comedians / basketball players that traveled all over the world. But unbeknownst to me and most of white America, there was sort of this underground game that was being played in Brooklyn and Pittsburgh and Baltimore and Washington, D.C., black YMCAs, black dance halls. And, you know, it's chronicled as a great black historian named Claude Johnson, who runs something called the Black Fives Foundation. If any of your listeners could get it up on, you know, Google the Black Fives, I think that is the website, Black Fives Foundation. And it's really filled with the history of basketball, which was pretty much these legit African-American teams that couldn't get into whatever form of white games were going on then. And they played this circuit, and they were great great, great basketball players. So the game was sort of spreading along these parallel tracks, that there was a white game being played in colleges, high schools like we talked about in Indiana, lesser in the pro. They came along in the mid-40s. And at the same time, this underground kind of black game, and the twain really never did meet until the 1950s. And it was players like when Oscar's team at Crispus Attucks won the state championship in 1955. I mean, this was a revelation. As soon as 5 years before that, many fans in Indiana had never seen a black person, never mind a black team, which had a black coach, a black fan base, a black pep squad. I mean, this was really new stuff. And when Oscar's team made the finals in 1955, it was really this explosive year, because it's the same year that Bill Russell and Casey Jones, the same night, in fact, that Crispus Attucks won its state championship, Bill Russell and Casey Jones led the University of San Francisco to the NCAA title. And really, the game was never the same after that. It became a game that was certainly defined by African-Americans.
Jack, where does the movie Hoosiers fit into your book and this whole story?
Well, the guy that wrote Hoosier, Angelo Pizzo, who also wrote Rudy, by the way, and the director, David Anspaugh, grew up in Indiana. And they wanted to make a movie that was close to them. And so as the model, and emphasis on the word model, they didn't make a documentary about the team, but it was inspired by, I believe that's the language we're looking for. Their movie was inspired by the 1952 Milan High School, I think they were the Indians. They won the state championship. They were a really, really small, 75 boys in the class or something like that. They won the state championship. So they created, out of kind of whole cloth, this movie about a plucky underdog team. The team actually won. In the movie, it's set in 1952. The team actually won the state championship in 1954. Along the way, they played Oscar's Crispus Attucks team and beat them fair and square. Oscar was a sophomore. And the star of that team, Bobby Plump, who's represented in the movie by Jimmy Chitwood, he says, "Wait a man, it's a darn good thing we got Oscar when he was a sophomore, because he would have kicked our butts when he was a junior and senior." However, that Milan High team that won in 1954, they were no joke. They were really, really good. Bobby Plump went on to play at Butler. He was a good player. He was Mr. Basketball. They deserved what they got. But what happened was that narrative of the fictional team kind of overtook the Crispus Attucks story, you know, and in a way it parallels what happened to a lot of America, that the white narrative overtook the black narrative. So I'm hoping, you know, with the title, The Real Hoosiers, I didn't mean to denigrate the movie, which I watch and like and understand and appreciate. It's just to say that there's another story about a real team that accomplished really great things in the state of Indiana.
While all this is going on, Jack, and you write about it, the Ku Klux Klan is a major factor in Indiana. What was the background there? What was the story with that?
The Klan, strangely, for whatever variety of reasons, was biggest. It was, you know, the Klan really came along in the, you know, it was after the Civil War, obviously, but it had this kind of comeback in the 1920s for the reasons I talked about. There was an exploding black population that came into American cities and people got worried. It really hit in Indiana because Indiana is described as either the northernmost southern city or the southernmost northern city. It was settled from the South. So they had a lot of racial tension there, and the Ku Klux Klan reached its zenith in Indiana in like 1924, 1925, which was when Crispus Attucks High School was being built. And it was a kind of, it's not the Klan that we think of, riding amok and burning buildings. There was some of that, don't get me wrong, but it was a more subtle kind of Klan. They had social groups. They were allegedly religious. They held bake sales. They held basketball leagues. They held sewing circles. And what they also held in Indianapolis was positions on the school board. And so that was a lot of reason that this all-black school was created. So it was a more of a subtle kind of racism that was going on. And by the time Oscar came along, there was in the 1950s, there was not an overt Klan. You know, you didn't go to a game and there were people in white hoods there. But that kind of mentality, that sort of racial philosophy certainly held fast. And Oscar and his friends had to go through a lot of it in the city of Indianapolis in the 1950s.
What a book, folks. You'll get so much out of this. I did. Jack McCallum, the author of The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson, and The Hidden History of Hoops. Jack, I must ask you about Sports Illustrated, the sale, what's going on, this magnificent magazine that came at the end of every week and was just such an important part of all of our lives. What are your thoughts?
Well, I said there was another story about SI today, and I said to my wife this morning, I'm not kidding, I hope Pat doesn't ask me to explain the ownership because I cannot straighten it out. I will say this, that Sports Illustrated, and I was lucky enough to have been there. I wasn't the reason for the golden years, but I happened to ride along on that wave. The fact that it created such a brand, such a power in its brand, you know, it had a kind of Mack truck brand, you know, that nothing could, and we were like a lot of big corporations that thought we could coast a little bit. So we were a little bit slow on the internet stuff. And when new owners came in, they saw more of the flash and dash, the swimsuit issue, the idea of Sports Illustrated, rather than the fact that what created Sports Illustrated was the magazine. That's what all of the power and the mystique came out of. And the new owners, this is in my opinion, were kind of slow to understand that you got to keep that the magazine is what, you know, was the name. That, and things have happened in the publishing industry that, you know, we all know people are reading less, blah, blah, blah. Evening newspapers have gone out of business. But there is still an appetite out there for stories. And I think Sports Illustrated, you know, lost that. And now they're in this kind of entangled billion-dollar fight that the average person, I'm telling you, all of us who work there and who are now older and retired and left for various reasons, we all get together and our question is, what the hell's going on? And so we don't really know ourselves other than I think there's a buyer out there who's going to understand that it won't be the glory days, but there is still a way for Sports Illustrated to go forward with a print edition and some digital power. I'm not going to be out here Pollyanna thinking it's going to go back the way it was. It isn't. But I think there's a buyer out there who's going to understand that the magazine still has brand power through the telling of stories.
Folks, Jack McCallum in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, has been our guest. And get that book. You'll be so intrigued. The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson, who lives here in Orlando now, folks. And the Hidden History of Hoops. We've got more. Stay with us. I'm Pat Williams, your host. The show, Inside the Game, It's AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Jack McCallum, our guest in that first segment, longtime writer in Sports Illustrated. His new book is out, The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson and the Hidden History of Hoops. Well, Jack McCallum was in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and my friend Ann Liguori, who is CBS Sports Radio Network golf correspondent, is in Orlando, where she spends half the year. And we're going to talk about her new book, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. Ann, I can't tell you how happy I am to get connected here with you, and I hope you're well.
Pat, we've been longtime friends, and obviously I followed your career for many, many, many years, and it's just a pleasure to talk to you, to be on your show. Thanks so much for having me.
Tell me about your new book.
Wow, I'm very excited about it because, you know, like so many of your books, Pat, it's really positive and uplifting. I wanted to write a very inspirational book, so, and a golf book. And so I approached and interviewed 12 legends, six men, six women, and I asked them to share what they learned from their iconic golf careers that they use in their day-to-day life. Mm. And people like Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player and Tom Watson and Jan Stevenson, Nancy Lopez, they all were so gracious in wanting to be in the book and share their wisdom and their success stories and really stories that many stories that I had never heard before. And I've been covering golf for, 30 years. So I'm very proud of this book, Pat, because in these divisive times, not only in golf but in our society, I think this book has all positive and uplifting messages for everybody, men, women, young and old. So here we go.
Well, Ann, let's dive in order. Number one, Patrick Harrington, embrace fear and nerves and learn from your mistakes. Tell me about chapter one.
Patrick Harrington, first of all, I'm just thrilled and I'm pretty surprised that he revealed that he plays with fear all his life. He's told me that fear just heightens his focus. It brings adrenaline to his game and keeps his game sharp. But, you know, I can imagine these champions, all of us have nerves, right? Especially, I mean, these guys make a living playing golf. But fear, Patrick Harrington shared with me, three-time major champion, that he has fear every time he goes to the tee box. You know, will his game show up? Will he shank it off the first tee? Will he be able to play that day? Can you imagine having that kind of fear? And his take on it was that he embraces that fear and he embraces nerves and he encourages all to embrace fear and nerves and to learn from our mistakes. So the messages in his chapter, he talks so much about what he's learned from golf that he uses in his day to day. But I just thought that was just such a revelation that he plays with fear and nerves.
Now we go to a topic two, Tom Watson. Learn from the best, stay humble, and stay in the present.
Tom Watson told me he learned from the very, very best. He learned from Arnold Palmer. He learned from Byron Nelson. And he learned from his friend and rival back in the day, Jack Nicklaus. Mm. And, you know, it's just so interesting to hear. He said he would sit on the range in his younger days and just watch Arnold Palmer conduct business on the course, from the way he practiced to the way he interacted with people. And, you know, Arnold gave him some good advice. He played with Arnold back in the day when Tom was very, very young. He won a tournament in Kansas City at the age of 14. Mm. And he got an invite to play with Arnold Palmer, then Jack Nicklaus. And he said golf taught him humility. He said Arnold Palmer advised him to play in as many competitions as he could. And at 15 years of age, he actually played against Arnold Palmer. He tied Arnold Palmer on the front. He shot a 34. Mm. And on the back, however, Tom shot a 40, and Arnie shot another 34. So he learned that, you know, you can't, it's not over till it's over, basically. You know, it taught him humility. His father taught him humility as well. And he just really advises all of us to try to learn from the best and look up to mentors, get mentors who are the best if possible. And he goes into his whole rivalry with Jack Nicklaus, how they would beat each other through the years. But when Tom was first starting out, he sat behind Jack Nicklaus on the range too and watched him very closely and watched how Jack Nicklaus conducted business. So I think there's so much you can learn from Tom Watson. He obviously captained, you know, the 93 Ryder Cup at the Belfry. And I asked him, you know, what was the most pressured situation he's ever been in and the players have ever been in that he worked with, at the, you know, that he captained at the Ryder Cup. And he said, you know, pressure sometimes is just beyond the abilities of the players and to be able to deal with it. And I asked him, well, how did you deal with that as a captain? And he said he just tried to rely on humor to keep everybody loose. And his advice was just, you know, really to try to play in the moment. Stay in the present is what you hear from a lot of these golfers, Pat. Stay in the present. But that is just so very hard to do. But it's a lesson that we can all learn and try to do, not only on the course, but in life. Stay in the present.
Topic number three, the pride of Australia, Jan Stevenson. Goals set your way to success. Tell me about my friend Jan Stevenson.
Jan Stevenson, oh my gosh. Her chapter, yes, set goals and really try to, in golf and in life, just try to, you know, goal set your way to success. And Jan just came over to this country as a young rookie, blonde-haired, blue-eyed golf phenom. And, you know, the LPGA really used her as, you know, basically the sex symbol of the LPGA, you know, much to the dismay of her fellow competitors. They weren't happy about that. And looking back, Jan really talked in detail about that period in her life. The commissioner, the LPGA commissioner back then, Ray Volpe, it was, you know, his idea. Jan had a lot of sex appeal, and they used Jan to promote the LPGA. So she pretty much became the face of the tour back then. And she said to me, you know, had she perhaps been able to practice more and play more instead of doing all the things required to promote the tour, she probably could have won even more than she did, right? But boy, what a life Jan Stevenson has had, you know, the ups and downs. We all remember in 1987, she was playing a tournament actually in St. Petersburg, Florida, and a car smashed into her, ran a red light, and basically, thank goodness she survived. She was actually co-leading the tournament after 54 holes, but she had to withdraw. And then a couple years later, in 1990, she was mugged in the parking lot of a Miami Heat game. And they tried to steal her purse, breaking a finger. She injured her left hand. To this day, she still does not have feeling in three fingers on her left hand. Mm. And I had the opportunity to play in a celebrity tournament with Jan Stevenson a couple weeks ago in Tampa. And you can tell that she still can't really, you know, hold the club too tightly with her left hand. She still, you know, has these lasting effects from this injury. What in 1990, years ago?
Yes.
So she's had an incredible life, ups and downs, and she is working on a movie about her life. And she told me that a film company has basically, you know, come into the picture, and that Margot Robbie wants to play Jan Stevenson.
Mm.
But she also shared with me, Pat, that they wanted to change the script too much, to the dismay of Jan, making it raunchy and you know, things like her making out with guys in the parking lot before a tournament. And, you know, they wanted to take their Hollywood creative licenses to a degree that Jan wasn't happy with. So stay tuned with that. I think we're going to eventually see a movie about Jan, but we don't, you know, hopefully it will be more accurate to her real life, and they won't take too many creative licenses. But Jan Stevenson, she has businesses now. She's doing very, very well. Wine and Spirits Company that she runs. She has the Jan Stevenson Crossroads Foundation. She bought a golf course in Palm Harbor, Florida. She's doing some architectural course design work. Mm. And boy, she has a full life. So it's always a treat to catch up with the great Jan Stevenson.
Number four, Amy Alcott, be the captain of your own ship and trust yourself.
I love this chapter, Pat, because, you know, Amy did not come from a golf family per se, like my family. I mean, my parents were very encouraging, as were Amy Alcott's parents. They would drive her to wherever she needed to go. But she basically initiated her own career and just loved doing things on her own. She made her own decisions. She decided to turn pro and not go to college, much to the dismay of a lot of people that, you know, tried to basically tell her how to go about her life. But she just stuck to her own guns, and, you know, there are great stories in there. You know, she'd be out, she would sneak on Riviera Country Club and play with the boys when she was young, and she'd stay on the putting green practicing till all hours, and her mother would drive up to try to pick her up, and she'd still be putting, so she'd go down and try to get her, and she'd be putting next to famous people like Rita Hayworth, and didn't even know it was Rita Hayworth until her mother pointed it out. So she tells some tremendous stories in that chapter, and just great life lessons from Amy Alcott as well.
Anne Liguori is my guest. Her book is out, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. We need to take a break, but when we come back, Jack Nicklaus, put family first and integrity is paramount. I'm Pat Williams, your host for Inside the Game. We get to talk sports every weekend with some fascinating people right here on AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Anne Liguori has been around the golf scene over many, many decades. And her book is just out, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. And Anne, as I mentioned before the break, tell me about Jack Nicklaus.
Wow, Jack Nicklaus. Well, first of all, I'm just so honored that he gave me so much time. And obviously, the legend beyond all legends, right?
Yes.
And as you mentioned, his chapter is all about putting family first and integrity is paramount. And, you know, golf was very important to him, but not as integral as his family. It all happened, he said, because he made a couple of 4-foot putts, which I love that line. But he really believed that being a father came ahead of chasing a trophy. You know, he has 5 children, 22 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren. And it's really all about, it's always been about the family. You know, he used to fly back from whatever tournament he was in after playing the third round to catch his son's football or baseball game in Florida, and then fly back to the tournament in time to play the final round. And oftentimes he'd win those tournaments. So he just had this uncanny ability to be able to, you know, be a great role model and a great father, in addition to being the greatest player in golf. He tells some great stories about his career. You know, I have five Masters, former Masters champions in the book, Pat. And, you know, I just really highly recommend everybody picking up the book, not only to hear all this life wisdom, but to hear all these legends talk about their careers, and particularly, you know, the guys who won the Masters as the Masters is approaching. I'll be covering my 26th Masters, and for WFAN in New York, I have a show called Talking Golf with Ann Liguori on Sundays. And all these former Masters champions just share so many great stories and great history. So, you know, whether you're a diehard golf fanatic or not even a golfer, I think you'll enjoy this book because you'll learn so much about, you know, these personalities and their success stories, and hopefully be inspired in this at the same time.
And I'm going to jump ahead because I don't want to run out of time without you talking about a native here living in Orlando, Annika Sorenstam. Golf taught me patience and so much more. I want to hear about Annika.
Annika Sorenstam is so gracious. In fact, she thanked me for including her in this book. That's how just incredible Annika Sorenstam is. Basically, you know, she learned patience and so much more playing golf that she uses in her day-to-day life. Patience you must have as a golfer, and she uses patience as a mother of two. And, you know, there are no shortcuts to success. She shared a great story, Pat, of being on a practice range in Sweden when she was a teenager, and it started to rain. So she called her dad and asked him to come pick her up. And as they left, he drove past other junior golfers who were still on the range, just being pelted by raindrops. And her dad turned to her and said, "Annika, there are no shortcuts to success." And she looked at him and she just felt terrible. And she said, "Those words made me feel so uncomfortable at the time." But then she said, you know, they later became embedded in my head. And she said, I never left the practice range after that, whether it was raining or getting dark or whatever the elements were. She just realized that there are no shortcuts to success, and work ethic is so important. And years ago, I interviewed the great Ted Williams. I was in my 20s, and I was doing a show called Sports Interview with Ann Liguori that was syndicated around the country on you know, regional sports cable networks. And to this day, I can just see this intimidating presence of Ted Williams looking at me when I asked him the key to his success. And he said, "Annie, practice, practice, practice."
I can just hear Ted.
This is so true. There's no shortcut to success. You have to put the work in.
And now another one of my favorites, Nancy Lopez. Stay positive and play happy golf. Tell me about Nancy.
You know, I have to say, isn't that so incredible, you know, just to stay positive? That advice seems just so simple, but it's not. I mean, on the golf course, it's so hard to stay positive because you're only as good as your last shot, and it's really the most challenging sport that I've ever played, and that people, you know, the pros say it's the most challenging sport ever. But, you know, off the course, you know, a deal that you're working on goes sideways, or something happens in your personal life that doesn't quite, you know, isn't quite great. And you're just, you just want to feel sorry for yourself, or you just get discouraged or frustrated, but you have to stay positive. As Nancy Lopez, you know, really emphasizes in that chapter, it's so difficult to do, but you have to look at the light at the end of the tunnel. You have to stay positive. Things will totally turn around if you can stay positive, and I just love that advice. It seems so simple, but it's certainly very, very difficult to do, particularly on the golf course and then in real life. So Nancy Lopez now has, you know, she's teaching her Nancy Lopez Golf Adventures. They go all over the world teaching that message. So not only is she teaching people the joy of playing golf, she's also teaching them, you know, at least trying to teach them to stay positive, because that's such an important part of the sport and in life. Stay positive.
Now I want you to go back and talk to us about Gary Player. Have a lifelong passion for what you do and have love in your heart.
Gary Player is the epitome of passion. You know, his advice is pursue what you're passionate about. And that is just such great advice to all of us. He is 88 years young. Mm. He plays golf every day. Mm. He works out every day. And he's very, very careful about what he eats. He's really into nutrition. And I think those are things that we really all can learn from. I remember interviewing him a couple years ago for a TV program. And I joined him doing push-ups and sit-ups in the driveway of his daughter's house. I mean, he just doesn't stop. And I love that. I guess, you know, if we're going to do anything in life, you know, we're working, what, 24/7, really pursuing what we love. I think that's the best advice. If you have to do anything, really try to do what you love to do. So Gary Player talks about so many different things, but that was one of the key themes in his chapter. And you know what's interesting, Pat, is all these legends, these 12 legends that I interviewed within the last year for this book, they all came up with different wisdom, different themes. I didn't have to coach them on any of it. You know, we learn so much from golf. Golf is kind of like a microcosm of society. But I didn't have to, like, tell them, oh, well, I want you to talk about this and you to talk about that. They
yes.
all just came up with different themes, and then I kind of focused on those themes. But we learned so much from golf that we can use in our day-to-day. And they were also all so gracious. They just were so generous with their time and really wanted to be part of the book and share their wisdom, which is just so wonderful in today's day and age.
And the next one for you is Ben Crenshaw. Treat people well and let destiny guide you.
That's right. Ben Crenshaw, such a gracious man and a very religious man as well. And he just, you know, he learned so much from the great Harvey Pinnock. And, you know, he just talks about letting destiny guide him and having Harvey Pinnock as a mentor from the earliest years he can remember playing golf. He was just so fortunate that he met Harvey Pinnock, who became not only his golf instructor, but became his life mentor. And everybody remembers the story of when, you know, Ben Crenshaw was playing the Masters and the great Harvey Pinnock had passed away that very week. It was earlier in the week before the Masters even started, and Ben left to attend Harvey's funeral and to be, you know, to be involved in the service, and then came back and won the Masters based on being just so inspired and so moved by Harvey and everything he had learned from Harvey Pinnock. It's just an incredible story. What a magical ending, you know, to that week for Ben Crenshaw. And what a tribute to the man and mentor who coached him about golf and life. It was truly destiny. And so Ben talks a lot about not only that, but so many other relationships in his life and in golf that he really believes were because of destiny.
And we've got about 2 minutes to do Dottie Pepper. Be prepared and maintain balance in your life.
Dottie Pepper, boy, you know, when she was growing up as a golfer, she had a great mentor as well, and she learned a lot and later wrote about this man and coach in her own book. But she said she learned about time management in college and how to be prepared. Golf teaches you so much about preparation, what to wear, how to be organized, what to put in your golf bag. You know, when you're young, it really teaches you life lessons that you can use forever, right? And now as a commentator for CBS, she's a golf analyst, she says for every 4 or 5 hours of airtime, she puts in at least a dozen hours of prep work. And you and I can relate to that because it takes so much prep work to do anything when you have an on-air show. So, yeah, Dottie Pepper, just delighted that she could join the 12 Legends in the book. And her theme is be prepared. And we can't, you know, I can't thank them enough for all their their great wisdom in the book, and boy, it's very inspiring to this day, even for me, to just take their lessons and try to live up to them.
Ann Liguori has been my guest here on the Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. We do this every weekend. Ann's book is out. Boy, it's a must-read. Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. You've got a nice little sample of it here as we chatted with Ann, but make sure you get that book. We're back next weekend for more Inside the Game, the name of the show. Pat Williams, your host. It's AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Have a wonderful week ahead. Good sports.
Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.